thank the organizers for being able to speak here. So what I'm going to talk about are some results about infinite discrete groups, mostly, but I'll give some of reason why you would care about them at a von Neumann algebra conference, so some of the applications that they have there. So G will be an infinite discrete group. And we'll be looking at a representation of G into the unitary group of some Hilbert space, call it pi. And so let me recall what the first cohomology group is with regards to this representation. So a one cocycle is a map from G into the Hilbert space. So if it satisfies the cocycle relation, so that is that B of G1, G2 is equal to B of G1 plus G1 times B of G2. So I'll just go ahead and not put pi here, but the action I mean by pi of G1 on B2. And we say that B is inner if there exists some vector C such that the cocycle is just given by multiplication by that vector, so 1 minus G times C. And one not too difficult thing to see is, in particular, that the inner cocycles are the same as the bounded cocycles. There's a little simple trick to show that. So note, B is inner if and only if B is bounded. And the reason that this is true is consider the action of G on this Hilbert space. So this will be a new action, and it'll be defined as alpha of G applied to a vector C is just going to be G times C plus the cocycle at G. And you see that the cocycle relation right here tells you precisely that this will indeed be an action of the group on the Hilbert space. So this action will, in particular, not preserve the origin, but it will preserve different distances. So this will be an affine action. And you can look at the orbit of this action applied to the vector 0. And you see that this is precisely going to be the values of your cocycle, since the first part is just trivial right here. And so if this is bounded, then that means that this has a bounded orbit, and you use the fact that any bounded set in a Hilbert space has a unique center. So since we're in a Hilbert space, any bounded set has a unique center. Moreover, since alpha is an affine action, it preserves distances, and so therefore, so I'll call this x, and call c the center of x. So alpha preserves distances, and so in particular it will preserve the center of x since it has the unique center. So therefore, alpha of g times c will be equal to c. But what is this? This is just g c plus b of g. And there you have your inner vector right there. So this is a useful little trick to show that bounded cocycle in place here. So the first cohomology of the group with values in this Hilbert space is just going to be defined to be the set of cocycles. So these are one cocycles and mod out by the set of inner cosecants. And one useful thing for one reason why you might be interested in looking at these cohomology spaces is to see when or not they might be trivial. And there's a results of Dorm and Guichardet, which says that G has property T. So if and only if these cohomology groups are all trivial. On the other hand, you can also talk about this. So this isn't the original definition of property phi, but this is equivalent. And you can also describe the Hagler property in this setting. So G has the Hagler property. So if there exists a proper cocycle. So by proper, I mean that, i.e., so there's some cocycle into some representation such that the set of all of G and G, such that B of G in size is less than fxk, is finite for all k. So it goes off to infinity. And the reason that these are true, at least one direction I'll point out to you, and that is that if you have a cocycle, then you can look at the norm squared of this cocycle and take the exponential of this, put in a minus t there. And it's a result of Schoenberg that these are positive definite functions, so this will give you a positive definite semigroup, so I'll call this Pt of G. And it will converge uniformly, the semigroup converges uniformly, if and only if it's bounded. So in particular, if that tells you that if you have property T, you know that these semigroups converge uniformly, so you mean that that tells you every cocycle is bounded. On the other hand, if the cocycle is proper, that tells you if and only if that this function is C0. So this tells you that if you have a proper cocycle, then you get a semigroup of positive definite functions, which are all C0s. They're all compact, and this gives you the Hagler property. And then there's similar little tricks to go the other way for both of those implications. So in particular, if you want to reduce the spaces that you're looking at, the cohomology spaces that you're looking at, you can kind of view these properties for those spaces as kind of a generalization or weaker version of property phi or the Hagler property, and this is definitely a motivation. So another thing that you can get out of these one cocycles is that if L of G is the von Neumann algebra, so given by G acting on its left representation, and if you have a cocycle which takes G into some representation, then you can naturally define a derivation from this cocycle on your von Neumann algebra. So how do you do this? First, you want to define a bimodule. And how you do this is you take the Hilbert space and tensor it with L2 of G. And then you define the action on the left will be the action that is given by your canonical unitary applied to some vector C tensor eta. Will just be your representation G applied to T, and then tensor at the left regular representation. So lambda of G applied to eta. So this extends to a normal mapping. So it gives you a module on the left where you're running an algebra. And on the other hand, you have a module structure on the right. Since the left regular representation also has a right regular representation. And so how you do this is you don't do anything to the first component, and then you can just take the right regular representation of G inverse. So these give you a bimodule structure, yeah? Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you. Otherwise, that's kind of silly. Thanks. So that's how it acts on the right. And this gives you a bimodule structure on this, and you complete this to get a bimodule Hilbert space, and you can define a derivation. So the domain of this derivation will initially just be the group algebra, and this will go into your bimodule, and it'll just be defined as delta of some UG is just going to be the cocycle evaluated at G, tensor delta G. And then you check that this is indeed a derivation, so that you extend this linearly on all of the group algebra, and you can check that it's a derivation, mainly that the delta applied to xy is going to be x delta applied to y plus delta applied to x times y. So it's a derivation. And furthermore, you can check that this derivation will be inner, so delta is inner if there exists some C and H twiddle such that delta of X is given by XC minus CX. So this is an inner derivation. And this derivation will be inner if and only if the cocycle is inner. So this gives you some nice information on your von Neumann algebra level. And I'll come back to this a little later. So I mentioned before these results about property T and the Hagrid property can be viewed in this way as looking at cocycles on the group. So one interesting thing to do is to try to restrict your representations and see what happens there. So of particular interest is the left regular representation. So you have the left regular representation, and you can look at the cohomology of the group and this. And the nice thing about the left regular representation I mentioned before is that it has this right regular representation which commutes with it. So in particular, if you take a cocycle, from G into L2, and if you take an element of the von Neumann algebra, then you can act on your cocycle by acting on the right. So you can look at B of G and then times X, where XX on the right. And you can see you can look at this. So this will, B times X will give you this, and it will again be a one cocycle. And so in particular, you have an action of the von Neumann algebra on this cohomology space. So this gives you a module of your von Neumann algebra, and in particular, you can take the dimension of this module by Luke. So you can take Luke's dimension, and this is, so you can look at the dimension from the von Neumann algebra acting on the right of H1G L2G. And you can see what kind of information this gives you about the group. And it turns out it was first shown by Beckett and Vallet in 1997 that this is precisely the first L2 Betti number of the group. And they showed it in the case where the group is non-amenable and finitely generated. But it turns out that from results of Luke as well as results of Andreas Thom. Well, I should also mention that the work I'm speaking about today is joint work with Andreas Thom. But by their work, it turns out that this actually holds for general groups, so you don't need finitely generated and you don't need non-immutability. In fact, what's also true is you can look at the cohomology space from G, rather than looking at it from G into L2, you can look at it into the affiliated operators. So I'll say U of G. So U of G, this will be the affiliated operators so on L2 of G. So that are closed operators on L2 of G, which commute with the right action. So these are the affiliated operators, and you can also look at the dimension function of this, which is again a right module from your G action, and this is the same dimension. Furthermore, what's nice about this cohomology space, and what's really allows you to push a lot of techniques to get very far, is that it satisfies the property that the dimension is going to be zero if and only if the cohomology vanishes. So in general, this isn't true. In general, this isn't true for this space, for instance. For example, if you have an amenable group, then there's always non-trivial cocycles into the left regular representation. The reason why this is true is because the left regular representation will almost have invariant vectors, and so given invariant vectors, you can create an approximately inner cocycle. So in general, this is not true for other modules if you're looking at besides the affiliated operators. So this is something that you can really use to exploit properties here. So I mentioned before that property T is the same as saying that the cohomology vanishes for any representation. So we see here that at least for non-amenable groups, this will be true. So for non-amenable groups, saying that this cohomology vanishes is saying that the first Betti number is trivial. And so we can kind of view that as a very, very weak form of property T, which is useful for me. And so another thing which is also useful is to consider the analog of the Hagerup property. So this will be a big strengthening of the Hagerup property for when you have a proper cocycle into the left regular representation. So this will be something to think about, which is the case for free groups, for instance. So for this talk, I'll go ahead and take this as the definition of the first L2 Betti number. The original definition is due to Atiyah in the late 70s, and since then, there's been a lot of work on the L2 Betti numbers, but from my perspective, this is the definition that I'm going to be interested in. So let me give you some examples. Cheeger and Romov did it for more general groups, and also Luke did it with dimension functions and such, more generally than that. But it originally stems from Atiyah's work. So let me give you some examples of. I should also mention. So if you have some cocycle from G into the left regular representation, if G is proper, and G is non-amenable, so I mentioned that this is true for an arbitrary group. For a non-amenable group, you can also show that the cohomology of the left regular representation will be trivial if and only if the first Betty number is 0. And the reason that this is because the non-amenable groups, the left regular representation doesn't weakly contain the trivial representation. And so you can't get into the same pitfall that you can for amenable groups. So in particular, if you have a proper cocycle on a non-amenable group, then this, as a consequence that the first Betty number, first delta Betty number of G is going to be greater than 0. In particular, every non-amenable subgroup of G will also have positive first Betty number. This is because they will also have a proper cocycle just by restriction. So this is something useful. Finding groups for which this is satisfied seems a bit tricky. So this is true. This holds for free groups. Or more generally, free product of amenable groups, or even more generally, free products of amenable groups over amalgamated over finite subgroups. And this is something that's not difficult to prove. Unfortunately, these are the only groups I know that have a proper one cocycle. But which is a bit unfortunate, but you know, maybe, who knows. So let me give you some examples of the first Alto Betty numbers. So one very nice example is that the first Alto Betty number of the free groups is just n minus 1. And the reason why this is a very nice example if you're into von Neumann algebras is because there's been a close connection shown between the first L2 Betty numbers and free entropy dimension. Specifically, it's been shown so I want to find what delta star is, but it's a non-microstates free entropy dimension defined by Verkhovsky. And it's been shown that the free entropy dimension of generators, the non-microstates free entropy dimension of generators of your group is going to be precisely the first L2 Betty number of the group minus the zeroth L2 Betty number of the group plus 1, where that this is 0 if the group is infinite. So this was shown by Kahn and Schlechtenko. So they showed one inequality, and the other inequality is Miniev and Schlechtenko. Yeah. So one would hope, therefore, that you can, from this fact that the free groups have these different Betty numbers, that maybe you can say something in this direction, or maybe you can say something about the free group factors. But as of yet, this has been not able to be done, precisely because you only know this about one specific generating set of your group. So you don't know about different generating sets if this holds. Okay, so that's good to keep in mind. Another one is that the first L2 Betty number of a group vanishes if G contains an infinite normal amenable subgroup. So this was first shown by Cheeger and Gromov. And you should really think of this in terms of the free entropy dimension with the analogous result by Voicolescu, which states that if you have a von Neumann algebra, a 2-1 factor with Cartan subalgebra or diffuse hyperfinite subalgebra, then the free entropy dimension will be 1 for any generating set. So this is you see more connections right there. Also, the first Betty number of a product of groups is going to be trivial. So this is if both G1 and G2 are infinite. And this has been kind of known for a long time, but I think the first, at least the explicit proof that I know of is contained in a paper by Becca and Vallette. And also they show that the first Betty number of trivial if G has property T, which I mentioned from before, from this perspective of the dimension here, this is trivial. The property T implies this. So these are examples of groups which have vanishing first Betty number. I should also mention that if you take a free product of groups, so this will always be greater than zero. So this is if these groups are greater than or equal to 3, say, you can't have, if this is non-amenable, assuming. So this gives you a lot. Perhaps one of the more striking results about the first L2 Betty number is a result of Gaboriau, which states that the first L2 Betty number of G is trivial if G contains a normal, an infinite, normal, finitely generated subgroup. So this is a big strengthening of Cheeger and Gromov's, which state that if it has an amenable subgroup, infinite index, thank you. Infinite, normal, infinite index. Finitely generated subgroup. So this was shown by Luke in some nice special circumstances, but in full generality is shown by Gaboriau. So now let me tell you some new results in this sort of direction, and first let me define some notions of some sort of weak normality. So H, a subgroup of G, is quasi-normal if there exists some generating set, some S in G, a generating set, such that S, H, S inverse, intersect H, is infinite. So, for all S and S. So I'll be considering infinite subgroups H. So I'll say it's quasi-normal if you just have that this intersection is infinite for some generating set, and I'll go ahead and say that it's semi-normal if this is true, so S inverse intersect H is infinite, but rather than for all S in a generating set, for all S in the whole group. Right? So examples of this is, for instance, if you look at, say, GLNZ sitting inside of GLNQ, so this is semi-normal. I'm not sure if these terms are already taken for semi and quasi-normal. Probably, because I think pretty much if you say any word and then say normal after it, there's already a definition. So I'll just put normal. I'm sure there is. But I'll just go ahead and keep this. So if there's a different notion which you're familiar with, this is the definition which I'm taking. So this is an example of something which is semi-normal. Another example is if you look at, say, the subgroup generated by X in the group which has presentation XY, and then YX to the P, Y inverse is equal to X to the Q. So these are the Bomsing solitaire groups. So then it's easy to see that this is semi-normal. And another example to keep in mind is you can look at the free group generated by A and B. So the free group on two generators. And sitting inside of this, you can think of, again, the free group of two generators generated by A and B squared. And so this is quasi-normal, but this is not semi-normal, because, for instance, if you look at B inverse or something of this form or something like that, then you can see that it doesn't satisfy this. But just for A and B, it does, so for the generating set. So let me go ahead and give you a theorem now. So suppose we have H, a subgroup of G, quasi-normal. So again, I'm only considering infinite subgroups H. So suppose H is a subgroup of G, which is quasi-normal. So then we have the following inequality: that the first L2 Betty number of G is going to be less than or equal to the first L2 Betty number, again, first L2 Betty number of H. Actually, we can say a little bit more. Suppose I have another subgroup inside here, K, such that K, H is a finite index subgroup of K. So then we can actually improve this result. We can say that the first L2 Betty number of G is less than or equal to, multiplied by the index here, is less than or equal to the first L2 Betty number of H. So how does this go? Well, we want to go from the definition, which I wrote down here, from this dimension, from what we see there. And what we claim is that if you look at the restriction mapping from G into L2 of G, restricting your cocycles to H, that this is injective. In particular, that means when you take the dimension of these two things from the right action of G, then the dimension of this will be less than or equal to the dimension of this, which gives you the result. Actually, maybe I want K here. Well, I'll do the proof and see what happens. So the proof, I want. Okay. Note that if H is quasi-normal, then so is K. That follows from the definition. So the proof of this is that suppose you have some cocycle, and we're supposing this isn't injective, so suppose we have some cocycle which goes to the kernel here. So in particular, this means that the image of this cocycle under restriction is going to be inner, so therefore we can suppose, by subtracting inner cocycle, that B restricted to K is going to vanish. By subtracting inner cocycle, we can assume this. And then let's see what happens on our generating set S, So B applied to an element S. Well, on one hand, we know that SK, S inverse intersects K is going to be infinite. So let's take some of these K's which are in here. So say K sub n, and see what it does for this cocycle. Well, since the cocycle vanishes on K, we look at the cocycle relation. We see that this is precisely the cocycle pi to K to the n times S. But on the other hand, we can just rewrite this as S, S inverse K to the n S. But we're assuming that this element is also in K. So in particular, since it's also in K, we apply the cocycle relation again, and we get the S back. So the point being is that you have some vector in the left regular representation, which is fixed by some infinite collection. So this implies that B applied to S is going to be zero. And since this is true for every generator, the result is that the cocycle is trivial. So this is injective. So it's a very simple proof, but it all comes from this perspective of looking at the first delta Betti number of this way. I should also mention that by this example I gave here, that this estimate is sharp, mainly if we take the free groups of two generators sitting inside the free group of two generators, then we actually get equality there. So this is a sharp estimate. But we can actually say a little bit more in the case where we have semi-normality. So another example I should have mentioned over here is if H contains an infinite normal subgroup, so then this inclusion is semi-normal. So that's easy to see. So that gives you lots of examples. So one thing to notice from this proof is that in particular, if you have H, if H is your subgroup, and if there are lots of K's of larger and larger index, then what this says is that eventually the first delta Betti number of G has to get very, very small. In particular, it has to go to zero as long as the right-hand inequality is finite. And so the theorem which we can say is, suppose H and G is semi-normal, and that the first delta Betti number of H is finite, so then the first delta Betti, so this is infinite index, so H and G semi-normal. Infinite index. So then the first delta Betti number of G has to be equal to zero. So in particular, since if you contain an infinite normal subgroup, you have semi-normality, so this is a big generalization of Gaboriel's result about normal finitely generated subgroups. I should also mention that it just applied to the case where if you take G to be a free group, then since this is non-zero, this tells you a lot about the subgroups of free groups. In particular, if you take a free group and you take a finitely generated subgroup, then it can't contain of infinite index, then it can't contain a normal subgroup. And this is a classical result of back in the late 50s. And so in particular also for free products, this is a result of Bohm's flag in the 60s. So this is a generalization of some of those results. As well as if G is a limit group, it was shown by Pichot that the first Al-Tobetti number of G, so non-amenable, so you don't want to look at Z, so that the first Al-Tobetti number of G is greater than or equal to 1. And so you can also apply this to limit groups as well to get some nice things. So how does the proof of this go? The proof of it is kind of how I outlined up here. That is that the trick is to try to get larger and larger subgroups which are finite extensions of H. Of course, this isn't always possible. But a trick you can do, which is what Gaboriau realized, is that if you go to the actions of your group on probability spaces and look at the equivalence relation, so there you can still look at the Betti numbers and you can look at results like this. And the nice thing about that is that you can produce actions for which this is the case. I should have mentioned that. So this is a limit of free groups in the space of marked groups. Or another way to think of this is fully residually free groups. So this is group G is a limit group if for every finite set in G there exists some homomorphism to a free group such that H of G is non-trivial for all G and H. So this is for all G and F, thank you. So this is what's called a fully residually free group, which is the same as a limit group. Limit groups were introduced by Sela, and they can also be viewed as limits of group of free groups in the space of marked groups. So I'm running out of time, so let me not talk about the... Let me not talk about the proof, but rather let me give a few corollaries. So one corollary is suppose, let me first give a definition. So we're going to take a subgroup H and G, the commensurator of H and G is defined to be the set of G and G such that G, H, G inverse intersect H is finite index in both H and G, H, G inverse. So this is the commensurator of H inside of G. And one thing to notice is that H sitting inside its commensurator is semi-normal. Why is this true? This is because if you take anything in here, you conjugate it, you're going to get something of finite index, so in particular infinite, the intersection. So as a corollary, we see that call this if G has a proper one cocycle into the left regular representation, well, what does that mean? That means every non-amenable subgroup has positive first Betti number, so that means that you can apply this result to every non-amenable subgroup. So as a corollary, you get that if H is finitely generated, so then the index of the commensurator of with h is going to be finite. And you can also do this not for, so really the only fact that you need is that non-amenable subgroups also have positive first Betty number. So in particular, this also holds for groups measure equivalent to free groups. So this is a result of Gaboriau, that if you have a group measure equivalent to a free group, then every subgroup also has this property, and the subgroups, if they're non-amenable, will have positive first Betty number. So this, therefore, this also holds for that. And let me also say another corollary you get is, again, for this class of groups, groups with proper one cocycle, or groups measure equivalent to free groups, we can also say, also, if we take H in amenable, infinite amenable subgroup, so then H has a maximal, a unique maximal amenable extension. So why is this true? Because if you have two extensions, H1 and H2, which are both amenable, then you can look at the subgroup generated by H1 and H2. If you have a cocycle from this subgroup, then you know from what I mentioned before that the cocycle vanishes on H1, and it also vanishes separately on H2. So B restricted to H1 is going to be given by inner by some C1, and similarly B restricted to H2 is inner with some C2. And so what does this mean? Well, restricted to H, it has to, we have to have that, so therefore C1 minus C2, since it's the same vector as inner on H, so this is H invariant. But there are no H invariant vectors since it's infinite. And so you get that C1 has to be equal to C2. So you get that if the cocycle is inner. So there's a natural question you can ask in the von Neumann setting for this. So we have the following conjecture. So for the free group factors, do diffuse amenable subalgebras have a unique maximal amenable extension? There seems to be some evidence for this, which in particular, this would be a strengthening of the results of Ozawa and Popa, because there, if you have if you have groups of the normalizer, if it's non-amenable, then take two elements in the normalizer, which give you different amenable extensions. And so this would be a strengthening of their results. And this is also an extension to something which contains it. So given this diffuse amenable subalgebra, so A does have a maximally amenable extension. So extension meaning A sitting inside of B, where B is amenable, right? Yeah, so it'll be a maximal injective subalgebra which contains A, right? So and there seems to be also some evidence for this in Kinley Jung's work. So where there he shows that if you have two amenable subalgebras, if they have a diffuse intersection, then it's going to be strongly one-bounded, your Von Neumann algebra. So there definitely appears to be some evidence for this. So I'll leave this as a conjecture, and it looks like I'm out of time, so I'll stop. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Well, the useful thing about using the affiliated operators is because I kind of screwed over in a couple instances, but was the thing I mentioned before, that H1 of G with value system, the affiliated operators of G, is going to be trivial if and only if the first Betty number of G. In particular for amenable groups. And so what this allows you to do is if you have a general cocycle, and this is what I kind of skirted over up here, if you have a cocycle from an amenable group, so from G to L2 of G, and you have H an amenable subgroup of G, then it's not true that the cocycle is inner on H, which I stated when I told you this. But what is true is that if you view this as a cocycle in the affiliated operators, well, there you have this result. You restrict it to H, and you know that H is amenable, so this is 0. And so there is an affiliated operator on which it's inner. So what I set up here is that really these are in UG. So not in L2. And that's where I used it. And there's a couple other places, but yeah, that's definitely important.
So you told that the class of groups with having a proper one cycle in the regular presentation is basically those for which it's known.
Those for which it's known. So that's.
Are there more groups for which it's known that there are measure equivalent to three groups?
Well, yes. For instance, lots of limit groups are measure equivalent to free groups. In fact, conjecturally, all limit groups are measure equivalent to free groups. In fact, we see that there's kind of a big connection between limit groups, groups with proper one cocycle, and groups measure equivalent to free groups. And conjecturally, all limit groups are measure equivalent to free groups. The converse is, of course, false, since any amenable group is not a limit group necessarily. But it seems, you know, possible that it might be groups with proper one cocycle the same as groups measure equivalent to free groups. I can't give any real reasons why this should or should not be the case. That they have a proper one cocycle? Not that I'm aware of. Although probably you could do something. If you're amalgamating over a hyperfinite, probably you could do something.
If we